For those of you that don't know the Asian American Writers Workshop, we're the leading Asian American literary arts nonprofit in New York City. And what that means is we try to promote new and innovative ways of thinking about Asians and Asian Americans. How to be an American is really like the question that we kind of tackle in a lot of our programming. We do book signings. We just did the book launch for Maxine Hong Kingsley's memoirs, Woman Warrior. We also do book we do workshops like this one, and we also have open mics. Our last open mic actually featured Kelly Tsai. I don't know if anybody knows her, but she's a slam poet, and she was on 3 seasons of Russell Simmons' Death Jam Poetry. So we have a lot of really cool and interesting people like that. We're going to go through those. Yes, I'm trying to get a little bit. Obviously, very cool people that we have around. So the upcoming schedule of Lyceum's events. Thursday, February 17th, this is Thursday, at 4 in this space, we're having a workshop with Edlin and Eva Kalipa, who are doing How to Talk to Your Moms and Pops. So, like a workshop around how do you tell your parents that you want to start dating when you're 17? How do you, you know? So, that promises to be really cool. Tuesday, February 22nd, in this space at 4, we have How Does It Feel to Be a Problem with Mustafa Bayoumi and Terrence Chen, who are each in their own way kind of involved with post-9/11 like race issues. Mustafa Bayoumi has written a book about being a young Arab American man in post-9/11, and Terrence Chen has written a book about Tiananmen Square, about a fictional Tiananmen Square protester who is supposedly the only one who stood in front of the tanks as they rolled down the square. So that's going to be really cool. Monday, February 28th, at the Teachers and Writers Collaborative. We have a panel about how to be a famous writer with Aisha Pandey, who is a publishing agent, who's currently a publishing agent and a former editor, and we also have Jeff Yang, who is the editor of the only Asian-American superhero anthology ever published. And so they're going to do a really amazing workshop. To introduce this week's workshop, this workshop about how to be American when people say you're not. And to introduce our first speaker, Marina Cruz is an adult fiction author with a talent for kind of transcending genres. She also writes, she writes fiction and nonfiction, young adult and also adult. Her recent books include Ask Me No Questions About a Bangladeshi Family, caught up in post-9/11 sort of like security sweeps. She's also written a book about How Sugar Changed the World, which is actually kind of a really cool book, if you guys don't know about it. It's apparently her husband, herself, and a friend have all discovered one day that they had this connection with the sugar trade, which I don't know if anybody knows, but it's like tied to colonialization in a lot of different, very different cultural areas. Sugar production was like a kind of norm. So she wrote a very interesting book about that. And she's a visiting scholar at NYU's Asian Pacific American Center right now. And Marissa Franco is currently the coordinator of Turning the Tide campaign at the National Day Laborers Organization Network, and that's like a large umbrella organization that kind of does work to promote the domestic rights of day laborers in the United States. And she's been an organizer with a number of types of city labor organizations, City Alliance, and then the power of people organized to win employment rights and things like that. She's also one of the authors of a book called Towards Land, Work and Power, Charting a Path of Resistance to US-led Imperialism. So she's also been an outspoken critic of SB 1070, which is the Arizona set of laws, which are extremely fascinating and range from not allowing people, requiring that people who look foreign carry their citizenship papers on them, to people with funny accents cannot teach in our public school system. So, with that, I would love to thank you both.
Okay, so, you know, I sort of see myself as just a prompt for all of you. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my work, but, you know, really I'm here to prompt all of you and to think about the idea of how you can get out certain kinds of stories, perhaps the kinds of stories that you'd like to see out there, as opposed to the stories that are, you know, aren't there or are there. So I'll just tell you a little bit about myself. I'm going to read just some really short little chunk passages to give you a sense of where I'm coming from and what I'm aiming to do. One quick advertisement before anything. She mentioned Sugar Change the World, and I just wanted to tell you guys that on Saturday at 11, my co-author and I did a presentation actually in Brooklyn on that book, so you can learn more about it, and it's on Book TV 11. So anyway, because I'm not going to talk about that. What I really wanted to talk about is the work I've done thinking about writing about outsiders and immigrant teenagers, which is something that really matters to me, and these are the kinds of stories that I'm interested in getting out there. Quite a number of years ago, I wrote a book called Remix, Conversations with Immigrant Teenagers, and went around the country talking to different immigrant teenagers about their experiences, and this is way, way back in the late 90s, and so many of their stories resonated, and I made it very kind of across ethnicity. The only important thing was that they were able in some way to tell their story, that they had enough perspective that they could give me a sense of their story. Very often when somebody's first immigrating, it's so much is happening to them at once that they can't really process it into a story. Flash forward a number of years post 9/11, and 9/11 happened, and the Muslim registration happened, and the Bangladeshi community and many Muslim communities were very hard hit during this period. And I started thinking about those girls, those boys that I had interviewed, those young people. And I was thinking of writing more nonfiction about it, but it really hit me that what I wanted to do was write fiction, to kind of get inside of the heads of those experiences, these invisible teenagers, many of them undocumented, and not really clear if they were going to be able to stay or go or where they belonged, given what was swirling around in the post 9/11 period. So that became Ask Me No Questions. And more recently, I see these two books almost as speaking to each other. Tell Us We're Home is the next novel I wrote, where I started thinking, continuing my thoughts about immigration and immigrants and young immigrants, and what I became fascinated with, because I recently moved out to the suburbs, was the way in which American suburbs are so dependent on immigrants now. Immigrant labor, immigrant nannies, people who cut the hedges, sort of our entire existence is dependent on these invisible cores of people. But again, my focus is very much on teenagers. And so Tell Us We're Home, which was the next book, is about three immigrant girls, whose mothers are maids and nannies in a very wealthy suburban town. And so they go to school with the very same kids that their mothers work for, creating all these kind of interesting dynamics. So what I'm going to do, because again, you know, for me, those are the stories that are out there. Those were the stories that interested me beginning in the late 90s when I went out there more as a journalist and then as a fiction writer trying to imagine these worlds. Those to me were the invisible stories that I wasn't seeing written. So I'm just going to read you a couple of little passages to give you a sense of how out of that interest, that's what I created. So I'm going to read you one short passage from Ask Me No Questions, which is about the Bangladeshi sisters, and then a short passage from Tell Us We're Home. I remember when we first arrived at the airport in New York, how tight my mother's hand felt in mine. How her mouth became stiff when the uniformed man split open the packing tape around our suitcase and plunged his hands into her underwear and saris, making us feel dirty inside. Abba's leg was jiggling a little, which is what it does when he's nervous. Even then, we were afraid because we knew we were going to stay past the date on the little blue stamp of the tourist visa on our passports. Everyone does it. You buy a fake social security number for a few $100 and then you can work. A lot of the Bangladeshis here are illegal, they say. some get lucky and win the diversity lottery so they can stay. Once we got here, Abba worked all kinds of jobs. He sold candied nuts from a cart on the streets of Manhattan. He worked on a construction crew until he smashed his kneecap. He swabbed down lunch counters, mopped a factory floor, bussed dishes in restaurants, delivered hot pizzas in thick silver nylon bags. Then Abba began working as a waiter in a restaurant on East 6th Street in Manhattan. 6th Street is lined with Indian restaurants, each a narrow basement room painted in bright colors and strung with light, some guy playing sitar in the window. They're run by Bangladeshis, but they serve all the same Indian food, chicken tandoori and biryani, what the Americans like. Every night, Abba brought home wads of dollars that Ma collected in a silk bag she bought in Chinatown. The thing is, we've always lived this way, floating, not sure where we belong. In the beginning, we lived so that we could pack up any day, fold up all our belongings into the same nylon suitcases. Then over time, Abba relaxed. We bought things, a fold-out sofa where Ma and Abba could sleep, a TV and a VCR, a table and a rice cooker, yellow ruffle curtains and clay pots for the chili peppers, a pine bookcase for Aisha's math and chemistry books. Soon, it was like we were living in a dream of a home. Year after year, we went on not thinking about Abba's expired passport and the dresser drawer, or how the heat and the phone bills were in a second cousin's name. You forget, you don't really exist here, that this really isn't your home. One day, we said, we'd get the paperwork right. In the meantime, we kept going. It happens all the time. So, obviously that passage came out of my desire to understand the fragility of what it would be for a young person, an undocumented young person, during that period and that very, very tentative sense of belonging that they have. When I turned to this next novel, it wasn't with the immediate pressure of a young person who's undocumented, and yet I still sort of felt that I was interested in exploring what's it like to live in a kind of all-American suburb where you are in some way on the edges, and of course your mother is servicing on the edges of this town. So I'm just going to read a very short passage to give you a sense of how I tried to evoke that state of being. Being the daughter of a maid or nanny, it wasn't like everyone was so bad, mean, or stupid. It was just weird. You knew your mother put extra bleach in the underwear of some girl who was walking up the aisle at assembly in her best corduroy jumper dress? Or those shoes you wore were hand-me-downs from the kid in the grade above you, and you just prayed she didn't notice? Or how you hated Monday mornings when half the class came in sporting sweatshirts with big letters that said, "I rocked at Jonah's Bar Mitzvah," which of course you were never invited to. Anyway, I'm going to stop there just because I want this to be a prompt for all of you to get your juices going. I think, Marissa, we're going to turn it over to you. Okay.
Hey, everybody. Again, my name is Marisa. I'm a little tickled at the idea of being called a journalist. I think I more identify and voice myself as an organizer first, but it's nice. I used to want to be a journalist when I was younger. I just wanted to start off by asking just a question. You all are getting a show of hands. How many of you were born in New York? And then those that were born in New York, keep your hand raised if your parents were born in New York. And then folks that didn't raise your hand, if you could just shout out like where you were born.
Shanghai.
Where was that?
Uh-huh.
I was born in Phoenix, Arizona, in this small town near the city called Guadalupe. We'll come back to this question of like where we were born and where we are now. And I haven't lived in Phoenix for probably almost 10 years. I left actually to learn how to organize. There wasn't anything happening there, and I was really wanting to do something, and there was no organization for me. wanted to learn. So I left, and then that kind of just took me on a wave, and thought I was going back in 2 years, and I never did. And actually, the first time that I came back, I mean, I go back and visit a lot, but the first time like I came back and did organizing work, which is what I've been kind of like itching for, was this summer when SB 1070 was signed by Governor Jim Brewer. Everybody knows generally what SB 1070 is. You know, every year I would go home and would hear really terrible stories of what was happening in terms of the raids that were happening, the laws that were being passed. You know, every year attacks on affirmative action, every year attacks on bilingual education, now ethnic studies is banned. And there was something about 1070 that just, it was the straw that broke the camel's back. And so there was this interesting reaction in a place that isn't necessarily known historically for being a place of organizing. I spent my first years organizing in San Francisco, which is very different. It's like protest and organizing is like woven into the fabric of the city. And so I came home after 10 years and organized like people that I grew up around and people that, even though they were strangers to me, I recognized them, right? And it was a very, very moving experience. And so it, one of the things I wanted to share with you all is that it actually inspired me to write this piece that it was an article I wrote called The State of Hate. And it was about Arizona. And the way I was coming at it was remembering my grandparents who lived and migrated to the state of Arizona. And I wanted to invoke their memory and invoke their contributions to that land. And connect their effort and their labor and their contributions to the contributions of the people who are daily investing, working, and living in that state and who are now being essentially kicked out. So I just wanted to read that really quickly. Okay. So, to quote, we came to Arizona from the copper mines in Bananea. Recruiters came to Mexico trying to find people who would come work. We came in wagons. There was nothing here, nothing. They dropped people off from place to place. Our job was to clear the desert. And look at it now. Antonia Franco. I remember a childhood of listening to the stories of my elders, sitting at a kitchen table with thick mugs filled with warm milk and coffee. There was my Nana Tonya, who came in the early 1920s with her family from Sonora, Mexico. My Tata Emilio's eyes would gleam as he spoke, describing the orchard trees along South Mountain and Baseline Road, the ranches, the farms, all around. He loved to point out how much things used to cost in the early days, break down what it cost to feed his family and pay the rent, and match that to the wages he made as a janitor, a musician, and a groundskeeper. Stories like theirs constitute the backbone of the history of the state of Arizona. Their labor helped build the foundation upon which the fifth largest city of the United States operates upon today. And I wonder, what would they think about what is happening in Arizona now, days after the passage of the nation's harshest anti-immigrant law? In the Arizona of today, you can get charged with smuggling yourself. In the Arizona of today, the chain gangs of the Jim Crow era are alive and well. In the Arizona of today, undocumented students are forced to pay triple tuition for a college education. And after the signing of Senate Bill 1070, police can stop and question you because you look illegal. Arizona, a state built by the hands of many people of many colors and many languages, has taken another step in the wrong direction. So I think for me, this campaign and just the broader struggle that it represents, it both represents roots and it represents the image that I've been playing around in my head is a dove. Because there's something about where your roots are. So the people that were born here in New York, there's something about New York that'll always be something. It's just like something deep, right? But then for folks who are not born in New York, but you've been here, you're going to be here for a while, it'll always leave this fingerprint on you. And I think this idea that as people, like, we don't
where we are, that it's not a two-way process in terms of what we get and what we receive, and the inevitability and the naturalness of movement, both in terms of physical movement and growth as people and what we want to be and what we want to do, is now being criminalized and restricted by these types of laws. So I think some of the themes we had in terms of what we wanted to talk to you about was this question of migration and what it has to do with past and what it has to do with future and present and trajectory of, as human beings of where we come from and where we're trying to go. So we wanted to just get into a little bit of discussion about that and what this current climate represents and how it feels and this concept of what it is to be an American. And get into a little bit of a discussion about that and then have some time to get into some writing exercises if you want to come back up. So any thoughts or on that?
Maybe we should open with that whole question of, and whether it's even changed in your mind, that question of what it means to be an American. Was there a moment when you somehow felt more of an American? Was there a moment when you may have felt less of an American? Because, you know, obviously it's a pretty broad term. But maybe we could just open that up, just even that question of what you, if there's anything very specific to yourself, where that idea of being an American or being made to not feel like an American has some resonance. Does anybody want to start us off?
I can talk about that a little bit. My name's Quinn, and I'm originally from Vietnam, so it's really kind of crazy because when I meet a lot of people, they have zero idea that I was not born in this country. Sometimes these jokes come out and they say things like, where have you been? You know, weren't you born here or something like that? And I'm like, well, actually, no. You know, and people are really quite surprised. It's crazy because after living here for, 35 years, I was made to feel very un-American just last year when going to grad school, my social security number was flagged, and for some reason they had my name inverted, and so I had to go through social security, immigration, and the courts to have my name corrected on documents from 1975. And so it was a really strange experience to be going to these court buildings or whatever else and being looked at differently just because I was there for paperwork. So the immediate assumption from the security guards was that, oh, you don't belong here, even though I've been a U.S. citizen since, 1995. So it was an eye-opening experience for me, even though I've been thinking about these issues my whole life.
I think the country, the law, actually pronounces that there are two classes of citizens, whether you were born here or not, which is really not a good division because being a citizen is a state of mind. Mm-hmm. You know, and I think what you were talking about is once people find out that you weren't born here, they look at your society differently. And you haven't changed at all. But you see, we all fall trapped to that. In the beginning, your survey even, you ask a question, how many of you were born here? And how many of you were born elsewhere? And that is a problem. Because you can't create different classes of citizens. Once you do that, then there's no end to it. At one point, they excluded the Chinese. It didn't matter if you were born here. You could never become a citizen. So what does that mean, historically, being born here? Now they're restarting that thing again, that even if you understand, it's because we allow that to happen. There is either no class, or there could be two classes, three classes, four classes. It's endless.
I've never felt really like an American ever. And when people ask me who I am, I mean, I was born in Bangladesh, and I would say Bengali. I wouldn't say Bengali American, but I'd say Bengali. I remember the one time I felt American was when I got my citizenship, and I was 10. This is great. I was 10. And at first, I didn't think it'd make a difference because it's a piece of paper. But I realized the amount of value that some people put on a citizenship. Like, my parents were so proud. They were so proud that they became citizens, and then it wore off. I had this conversation with a friend the other day, and I mean, even though I don't always feel like an American, if someone questions me on it, I'll be like, no, I'm just as American as you are. I live here, I'm a citizen. Like, I'll bring that up over and over again, I'm a citizen. But she brought up the fact that she didn't really think I was an American because I was a foreigner. And I was offended, but then I thought back to the point where I didn't believe myself that I'm American. So I've been fighting with my own doubt about whether I am American or not. I think a lot of people do.
So one of the things I feel like is being teased out of this conversation are those moments where somehow not being born here, you know, obviates or puts into jeopardy this identity that you take it somewhat for granted, and that somehow that's the distinction that's, you said, use class, right? Now that's the distinction that's being made, which is really interesting. And other people are doing that, other experiences.
I actually share your view in that I think the question itself is a trap, in mm-hmm. that it's mixing your identity with a classification. Like, when I look at myself, I'm not American, I'm just me. I'm not even Chinese, I'm me. Because if you kind of say I'm American, and then people get confused, right? If I go to Africa and say I'm American, you know you're Chinese, right? I'm me. And then if you start doing like identity and you start mixing identity with just classification, then we all get confused. So that's the trap I think that the question builds on. As opposed to, are you American, or are you tall, or are you short, are you fat, are you thin? I mean, you know, you cut so many ways. Of course, American mix is a very important right. There's a lot of power with that. You don't get kicked out of the country, you have rights, you can only do whatever. But aside from that, the mix of identity really gets into a lot of trouble.
I just want to second that. Also, I think as an artist, and that's the reason why I'm here, to listen to your thoughts. A lot of times I think of myself as a stateless individual, not only that I'm not American, I'm not Indian either, I'm somewhere in between. And that is more of an identity versus my citizenship or national affiliation, whatever you may call it. I think it is also an issue to consider when I, for example, when I go back to India, nobody thinks I'm Indian. And over here, nobody thinks I'm American. So who am I? And I travel a lot for my work, and when I introduce myself and representing, say, an American publication or somebody to shoot, they're like, wait, you're representing so-and-so, but you're not American. I'm like, you know what I mean? So it's more of an identity issue, I think, as well. So just want to say that to you.
Just to add on that, I think it's also like the idea of what Americans should look like. Like, Americans should only look a certain way. I know, like, early days, they had, like, this idea of all American person, like, blue eyes, blonde hair and everything. And I mean, like, people hardly have any blonde hair, so I mean, like, it's just about your perception of what an American should look like.
I mean, absolutely. I forget what the statistics are in 2025 or 2030. I mean, just in terms of the demographics of the country, it's we're certainly, and certainly in certain states, we're no longer living in white majority states. So obviously, there may be an earlier kind of antique ideal of what an American is, but that's gone through so many demographic transformations in the past few decades. And I think that's in a funny sense what people are up against, right? That's what you that's the friction you're looking up against is some of these ways of thinking about what Americanness is versus the America of now, the sort of the cultural space of now, which is quite different. But I'd love to, yes.
Just, I don't want to fall the scene, yeah. But culturally also, I think there's a real change, because there was a time that at night, everybody would watch four different stations on TV, and everything was in English. So everyone knew Lawrence Welk. Everyone knew Ed Sullivan. You know, there were certain cultural things that everybody knew, which actually brought immigrants together. But now, with all of the globalization, you go home and your parents are watching, you know, things in Chinese or Korean or Hindi. You know, and so it's a strange thing that indeed one could continue to be, quote, multicultural in New York City, certainly. So I don't know, you know, I don't know whether...
I'm just going to say one small mm-hmm. anecdote that plays off of yours, but again, I want to hear from everyone else. A friend of mine was over, we were actually having a celebratory dinner because of what happened in Egypt, and my friend is a minority from Algeria, mm-hmm. and he was cooking us a couscous meal. And he used to work, you know, sort of a guy who lives in New York, you know, very with it, very hip, and his wife was saying to me, you know, his wife is so happy, he's no longer working in the restaurant business where he doesn't have to serve alcohol pork. And she said, do you think that's strange? I mean, when you look at him, do you think it's strange just that he comes from this world where, you know, they would be upset about that? And I said, no, you know. And I realized that she said, well, you know, a lot of Americans find that strange. And I think it's because there was a time when identity meant an either-or choice. And I think what you're pointing out is and what I think your comment points out, that it's perhaps we're somewhat moving beyond this idea of either or, right? That you can be somebody who seems to be very assimilated into a New York City space and at the same time have a family background that is rather uncomfortable with you working in a restaurant with alcohol, right? And it doesn't mean as if there's one or the other or he's choosing one or the other. But in fact, these spaces, these different overlapping spaces exist within him. And I think, you know, maybe what's really interesting to think about is how we can move past those either-or kinds of stories. You know, assimilation is a one-way sort of process. And perhaps there's more about the complexity of how we live, because we may not only live within one sort of cultural world. We may actually live in many different cultural worlds at once, even as we're a citizen of one country or another country, which I think is being suggested by some of your comments. But
yeah, if I could just, I mean, I think there's a question of one self-definition, but there's a question of what is the definition of American in this. Like, for me, I think Gloria Anzaldúa writes the best about this question of, like, borderlands is one of her books, Ni de aquí ni de allá. So for me, Chicana, my parents are Mexican, born in Mexico, I was born in Phoenix, 2 hours from Mexico, but very, culturally very far, right? I grew up saying I'm Mexican. It wasn't until I went to Cuba when I was 21 years old and someone was like, what are you? Mexican. What state? I'm from Phoenix. Well, you're not Mexican. And I was like, what do you mean, right? And then when I've gone to Mexico, same experience. Like, you don't have the same, you can't navigate and maneuver the way someone who lives there can. But then in the U.S., you're never quite accepted as American, right? Because there is, really, there is a concept of what an American is. And so I think this question of, like, us pushing up against, like, the paradigms of how we define ourselves, but then there's this aspect of what is it going to take or what does it look like to actually transform the concept of American? Last thing is related to that. I think that's a huge question. That's a huge part of this real tension around the question of immigration. I just found out yesterday that in Arizona, there's the sharpest this like distinction between an older white populace. So like there's the largest mm-hmm. amount of elderly white people, and the largest proportion of people of color under 18 is in that state. And so it's interesting now then to look at what's happening and the fights that are happening and over what and on what terms when you look at that statistic reality.
Okay. Well, let's hear
for,
I think I have one more person.
Yeah, I think whether or not you want to identify as American, kind of just on your own personal kind of level. And I think it's interesting how, depending on what parts of the country or where you're at internationally, how that can change, how people might see you a certain way. But for me, like why I've started, I guess, thinking about myself more kind of as an American, and I think that term's kind of problematic, but just kind of going with that, just seeing myself more as an American, because I think when I try to distance myself from that term, it's kind of a cop-out in some ways. It's like, I don't need to take responsibility over anything the government does. Any of the things that people don't like about America, I can always distance myself, because I can say, well, that's them, you know, I'm Chinese, I'm not really American. Mm-hmm. I think at some point, you kind of have to claim it, you know.
There's an ownership bonus that you're...
Yeah, I think because even if you are discriminated against, even if you are not seen as American, the fact that you do live here, the fact that you do pay some taxes, you are supporting the government, you are a citizen of this country, so then you have certain amounts of responsibility. So I feel like, I guess that's why I started thinking more about identifying as an American, because I feel like it's kind of unfair to just say, like, oh, I'm not really an American, I don't have anything to do with this. But you actually do, because you live here.
Yeah, you're talking about sort of a combat factor. I'm sorry, I just want to hear from one another.
Yeah, absolutely. You just need some success. I feel like I've done that a lot as well. I'll identify as an Indian who lives in America, but I realize what I'm trying to do is self to deny the fact that I am a part of this country. So lately, since I've lived here for a few years, I now identify as a New Yorker. And that just kind of makes me feel like a student of the world in some way, since New York is regarded worldwide rather than American, but I still apply to that issue. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. One more comment, and then we're going to move into actually. Oh, yes, yes.
Three days after 9/11, I was in downtown, and I was supposed to meet two friends for dinner at a restaurant, and the shops were closed and everything, and there were a bunch of teenagers sitting in the street corner, and it was, I was all bundled up because I guess it was cold or something, and they asked me, are you a Pakistani? And I didn't answer because it was a Friday evening. I didn't know if the kids were drunk or whatever. And I was trying to look for the place, and the address was wrong, and I was trying to make a phone call to my friend. And then they picked up a rock, and they threw it at me. And it missed my head and hit the shutters behind. And I just thought to myself, that's interesting, because until 9/11, people always spoke to me in Spanish. Mm-hmm. And they always presumed I was Hispanic. Mm-hmm. Everywhere. I mean, in LA, people would talk to me in Spanish all the time. When I walked into a store, they would tell me the prices in Spanish. In New York, people asked me directions in Spanish, even on the train. So it was very interesting that just within one day, people stopped calling me Spanish and started thinking of me as a foreigner. So for me, that was an epiphany in a way that, you know, but it's very interesting.
It's a tipping moment, yeah.
Yeah, it was very interesting suddenly, you know, how people stopped thinking of me in Spanish and started thinking of me as, you know, Middle Eastern. So that was my personal experience in terms of
some kind of shift that occurred.
Yeah.
These are all such interesting moments, and it's got me thinking about other kinds of writing prompts from your comments. What we partly wanted to do, obviously, was we wanted to play around with many of the ideas that are being discussed here. Does everybody have something? One question I want to see is if everybody has something to write with, that would be first. You know, I actually am now thinking, got slightly different number. I'm one of these people who, maybe it's my lack of commitment in a way to identity. I'm going to give you three possibilities, because sometimes people don't respond to the prompt you give them, and it's good for you to have some choice in this. It'll be something that will excite someone and won't excite another person. And so I'm going to give you three potential writing prompts. You can use, is there a marker here?
Oh, there's no
okay. All right. So I'm going to say that. So I'll speak slowly, so that, and I'll repeat it, so that you know you guys can mull it over and think about. So this kind of goes a little bit along the lines of what we were talking about, the idea of existing in more than one cultural space. And so the idea is write a list of five words you never hear at home, and then write a list of five words you never hear on the street that you hear at home. Okay? And try to imagine a circumstance where one of those words is heard kind of in the other space.
Can you repeat the second one again? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I'm going to do it again. Sorry. No, it's the same. It's the same exercise. My exercises tend to be a little elaborate. Okay, so five words that you never hear in your own home space, and five words that you've never heard out on the street or outside, okay? And can you imagine a moment where one of those words was heard sort of in the space that you wouldn't have heard it? In other words, a word that you would hear in your home space was heard out in the street or vice versa, okay? So that's just thinking about language, the way that language in so many ways informs the texture.
Can it be multilingual?
Absolutely, 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 absolutely. Okay, so that's one. Okay, here's the second possibility, okay? Pretend you are a tour guide, all right, and you are leading a tour of something intimate to you. It could be if you're out of school, it could be your home, it could be your family, it could be your neighborhood, and you are in some way a tour guide for that space that you take totally for granted, and you're having to explain it to a tourist. You're the person who belongs, but you're explaining it to the tourist. But something that's familiar and intimate to you. And then what I'd like to add to this, just because your conversations were so interesting, if any of you would like to write about those moments, like the moment you just wrote about, you mentioned, and actually put that down, some one moment, and make it really kind of just a key moment where you remember everything visceral that happened to you in that moment, where something in your sense of identity was shifted for whatever reason. So I'm just adding that to the, because so many of you sparked some very interesting moments in your lives. So I'm encouraging you, if you'd like, to write that one down. So we've got three writing prompts, right? One is using the five words, and as I mentioned, multilingual is great. Terms that we might not know, fantastic, okay. The second is pretending you are a tour guide who belongs and understands and is explaining an intimate space, be it a neighborhood, a school, family environment, to the tourist. And the third is if you would like to expand upon what we just talked about, a particular moment. Thank you.